logistic stuff. We have lunch from 12 to 1:30. At 1 o'clock, we're going to have a book signing. Pastor Poppy is going to explain that in just a moment. So if you would like to come to the book signing, you need to cut your lunch a half an hour short to make up for that, because we'll begin with our next paper. Is it Pastor Hales? At 1:30. So, Pastor Poppy, if you'd like to explain the book signing.
This is a first for us. We've never done this before, in part because we didn't invite speakers who had ever written anything. No, that's not true. We have. We just, you know, you think of it at the last minute, and you don't make the plans, or you don't build it into the schedule. We were hoping with Christian, Dr. Preuss, that we could have a book signing last year down in Nashville, and then he got sick and couldn't attend. So at 1 o'clock in the fellowship hall, the area where we've been eating, on the west side, one or two long tables are going to be set up. Hopefully all of our distinguished speaker authors will be there. And they have limited numbers of copies of their book available. You've got to talk to them about how much you have to pay for it and all that, what you want them to sign in it, you know, to my best friend Clint, that kind of a thing. With Christian Preuss, Dr. Preuss, we have his translation of Melanchthon's Commonplaces, and it is an amazing, amazing book. We used that for our Circuit Winkle during the time that we were here, and the only time in the history of our Winkles here where a vicar led the Winkles. But Christian was not the average vicar. His father, Rolf Preuss, brought along some copies of these recently published sermons on the Catechism. And they are published by Bender, is that correct? Okay, so they're not from CPH, but he brought along a satchel full of these. Pastor Hemmer, who just spoke, has recently authored this book, Man Up, CPH book. Our next speaker, Pastor Rieger, Sexual Morality in a Christless World, CPH book. And then the first speaker this afternoon, Pastor Philip Hale, has authored a book, and this is self-published, Confessing the Scriptural Christ Against Modern Idolatry. And so unless you're a Fort Wayne professor, most people have given rave reviews of this book. So it's outstanding. We're studying it right now with our elders. And you were given a free copy of the Zerbst book, The Office of Woman in the Church. We have a limited number of books available of these as well, $3 a copy. You got your first one free, the rest that we have, $3 a copy. And so we would sure like to get rid of them all before you leave. So this is what will be available at the book signing. We need our authors to try to cut your lunch to the point so you can be at the table at 1 o'clock. That'll give us 30 minutes to work through this whole process. We've never done it before, so have mercy on us and give us some feedback whether you think it was a good idea or not. And again, thanks to our speakers for arranging for or bringing books with them.
Thank you, Pastor Poppy. Back to your coffee. Don't spill it. Pastor Matthew Rieger, is that how you pronounce your name? Rieger? We'll be speaking on the theme, The Order of Creation and Sexuality. Matthew is the pastor of St. John Lutheran Church in Hubbard, Iowa. He and his wife, Dana, have been blessed with 7 children. I'm seeing a theme here, because I know Phil has quite a few. You had to have at least 4 kids to be a speaker here. Oh, you didn't do that. Yeah, well, that doesn't count. That doesn't count. It's all your kids' work. And I'm sure, is it Andrew that only has four? But he's working on five, I'm sure. Still practicing. Reverend Rieger was ordained in 1990 and has served parishes in the Iowa East District his entire ministry. He received his PhD from Durham University in England in 2004. Currently, Pastor Rieger serves as the second vice president of the Iowa East District and chairman of its board of directors. In June 2016, Concordia Publishing House published his book entitled Sexual Morality in a Christless World. He has also written a chapter about sex education in The Ethics of Sex, edited by Gifford Grobein, published by CPH in 2017. With seven kids, wonder if he's a closet preuss. Well, he certainly knows a great deal about our general topic, and we welcome Pastor Matthew Rieger.
Yep, I got a green light. Now I'm on. All right. Over the past 5 or 6 years, the majority of my research has been directed toward exploring the first century social context. In particular, the context of Roman views about sex and how they relate to Paul's theology. The claim is often made that Christian sexual ethics are based on an outdated model appropriated from ancient cultures that were patriarchal, of course, in the negative worldly view of the word, not a proper understanding of it, and misogynist. Since many of the biblical passages about sexual ethics come from the Apostle Paul, Paul himself is obviously a bigot. Man filled with prejudice and sexism, and blinded by the age and culture that produced him. He was simply incapable of thinking outside the box about relations between men and women. I heard that accusation made by university students when I was given the chance to lecture about sexual ethics at Iowa State University. It just is what the kids are being taught by their professors in the classroom. Well, as I said, the majority of my research has involved questions about sexual ethics. There's a definite overlap between sexual ethics and our discussions today about the orders of creation. The thrust of my presentation today seeks to address the question, was Paul simply a product of his times? Was he so shaped by the mindset of the status quo that he couldn't imagine different relations between the sexes than that defined for him by his culture? If all Paul was doing was parroting the teachers of his day, then the opponents of the orders of creation who accuse Paul of cultural appropriation might have a bone on which to chew. If, on the other hand, Paul's views on male and female were different than prevailing views, then the liberal charges against him collapse. Now, sociologically, and speaking purely in sociological terms, Paul's the product of two dominant cultures. In Acts, Paul claims to be a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. He wasn't just Jewish, he was a PK, Pharisee's kid, who began his training in theology while growing up in a very religious family. A chapter earlier in Acts, he told the people, I am indeed a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, according to the strictness of our father's law, and was zealous toward God as you all are today. So he was zealous for the religion taught him by the rabbis. He tells the Romans he was an Israelite of the seed of Abraham of the tribe of Benjamin. Time and again, Paul emphasized his Jewish upbringing. If anyone was shaped by a rabbinical Jewish faith, it was Paul. So score one for those accusing Paul of being a brainwashed product of his culture. It is necessary to ascertain what the rabbinical view on the relation between the sexes was that Paul would have been taught and which he then consequently would have adopted and should be clearly evident in his epistles. The first written code of rabbinical teaching was the Mishnah, written in the late 2nd century. The Mishnah represented the oral tradition of the rabbis dating back to the days of Paul and well before. Other sources of rabbinical teaching include the Tosefta, a commentary on the Mishnah written in the 3rd century, the Jerusalem Talmud being written in the 5th century, the Babylonian Talmud, which is the more authoritative Talmud, in the 6th century, both of which are, again, commentaries on the Mishnah. Though these sources were written well after Paul, they do record Jewish oral tradition that can safely be assumed to have been prevalent in Paul's day. These sources represent conflicting messages with regard to how the rabbis interpreted God's will for the sexes. Overall, one can say, they espouse a view that is extremely male-centric, that does not treat women as equally important in the eyes of God or equally valuable in the home. The Babylonian Talmud sums up a fundamental view of the relation between men and women by stating that women are a separate people. That separateness is manifest in women's exclusion from the public sphere, their unequal protection under the law, particularly with regard to marriage, and the general attitudes about their feminine character, all of which are elements coloring rabbinical views on the order of creation. One can grant that there are examples in the rabbinical tradition that speak to a husband's love for his wife or wives, such as Sanhedrin 76a in the Talmud. One who loves his wife as he loves himself and who esteems her by giving her clothing and jewelry more than he esteems himself ensures that his home will be devoid of quarrel and sin. It's not exactly a rabbinical command to love one's wife, but it at least acknowledges that loving one's wife will help alleviate tension in the home. Another text within the Talmud states that husbands ought not to impose excessive fear on their households by ruling them with too much severity. So there is at least acknowledgement that headship is not an excuse for abuse. Polygamy is assumed throughout the rabbinical texts. In fact, the Mishnah claims that it is acceptable for men to have multiple wives, but not women to have more than one husband, because the law to be fruitful and multiply was given to men, not to women. It further states that if a wife does not produce an heir for her husband within 10 years, the husband is encouraged to take a second wife. Even beyond encouraged, nearly commanded to. Indeed, the concept that the law does not apply to women in the same degree as men is implicit throughout the rabbinical writings. It's not just that the law might define different roles or vocations for women, as we would teach, but that the law really isn't meant for women in the same way that it is for men. An example. Whereas Deuteronomy 11:19 reads, and this is New King James Version, "Therefore you shall lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, and bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall teach them to your children, speak of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up." A Jewish midrash on this passage states, "And you shall teach them to your sons to speak in them, and not to your daughters whom they ruled." Now, a note. The New King James there translates the Hebrew as children. The word is, in fact, benim, sons. So the Hebrew does, in fact, read sons. virtually every English translation of that text translates the Hebrew as children, not just referring male, but collectively. The NSAB does translate it as sons. So it's not just that the Jewish teaching translates it as sons, but that it makes this special effort here to add that bit about, and not your daughters, because they're the ones who are ruled. We can ask a question, why? Why not teach the law to your daughters? There is actually a Jewish teaching on that too, and that is in the Babylonian Talmud. It suggests that teaching the law to daughters ultimately would increase their shrewdness against their husbands. So in traditional Judaism, women did not study the Torah. There was no need for it since men were required to study it, and they, not the women, would establish religion in the home and, of course, rule the home. Negative attitudes toward women in the rabbinical record are found throughout the texts. In the Tosefta, one finds the following. And note on this quotation, I don't know how, but the key to the entire passage I managed to leave out of it is a typo. So I'm going to insert a phrase that should be there that somehow or another isn't there. Don't know how that happened. Anyway, here's the quote. Rabbi Judah says, there are three benedictions which one must say every day. Blessed is he who did not make me a Gentile. Now, here's what should be there that isn't. It's the key to the whole thing. Blessed is he who did not make me a woman. Blessed is he who did not make me an uneducated man. Blessed is he who did not make me a Gentile. All the nations, Gentiles, are as nothing before him. Blessed be he who did not make me a woman, for a woman is under no obligation to keep the commandments. Blessed is he that did not make me an uneducated person, for no uneducated person fears sin. The Babylonian Talmud states, a daughter is a vain treasure to her father. Through anxiety on her account, he cannot sleep at night. Is a minor, lest she be seduced. In her majority, lest she play the harlot. As an adult, lest she be not married. If she marries, lest she bear no children. If she grows old, lest she engage in witchcraft. But the rabbis have said the same. The world cannot exist without males and females. Happy is he whose children are males, and woe to him whose children are females. I have five daughters. Don't consider any of them to be woe on me. The not-so-thinly-veiled message is that women are more problem than blessing. And while they are necessary for procreation, they are not really on the same level as men. When it comes to protection under the law in cases of divorce, women were at the mercy of their husbands. Quoting the Mishnah, the school of Shammai says, a man may not divorce his wife unless he has found unchastity in her. For it is written, blessed because he has found in her indecency in anything. And the school of Hillel says, he may divorce her even if she spoiled a dish for him. For it is written, because he has found in her indecency in anything. Rabbi Akiba says, even if he found another fairer than she, for it is written, and it shall be that if she find no favor in his eyes. This was the debate into which the Pharisees tried to drag Jesus in Matthew 19. Judith Romney Wagner, author of Chattel or Person, The Status of Women in the Mishnah, writes, from the standpoint of women's personhood, the most conspicuous feature of these rules regarding marriage and divorce is their one-sidedness. The wife's lack of corresponding rights against the husband reflect a polygynous system in which the wife is the husband's exclusive sexual property. But the reverse is not the case. We could go on with more examples, but the point seems clear that ancient biblical views on the roles of the sexes within the order of creation is something significantly different than what Paul taught. If Paul was simply a product of his Jewish roots and was repeating the biases of his formative culture, one would expect him to present an image of the relationship between man and woman that was repressive and negative toward women, one that favored polygamy, that made the woman the sexual property of the man, that encouraged unequal expectations under the law, and that did not emphasize the need for love within the marriage. The other cultural mother of Paul was Roman culture, and again speaking strictly from a secular point of view. In Acts 22, Paul claims his Roman citizenship in order to avoid being scourged by Roman soldiers. There it's even stated that he was born a Roman citizen. So how could a Jew, the son of a Pharisee, be born a Roman citizen? The options are limited. Either one could buy one's citizenship, which was extremely expensive and highly unlikely for your average Jewish Pharisee, or the other was to be gifted citizenship. For instance, slaves could be given citizenship by being especially good slaves and pleasing their master. That seems a more plausible explanation for Paul's citizenship. His father was probably under Roman servitude at one point and was freed. Paul, as the son of a freedman, would automatically have been considered a Roman citizen. Being born a Roman citizen also means Paul had unique access to the Roman Empire that the other disciples did not enjoy. His being the apostle to the Gentiles makes perfect sense, because those Gentiles were all part of the Roman Empire. Paul knew Roman culture. He knew the Roman mind. He moved about freely throughout Roman territory. Every congregation he founded was on Roman soil. So it seems plausible that Paul's views on sex and marriage would have been influenced not just by Jewish, but also by Roman culture. How then would your average Roman have viewed the relationship between the sexes? To say simply that Roman culture was patriarchal is a huge understatement. Roman culture was not just dominated by male leaders, the entire culture was about male domination. The ideal Roman male was strong in mind and body. Romans considered themselves to be masters of the world by divine right. They were to be dominant in all their dealings. Women were soft and weak. In fact, the Greek word used in the New Testament to describe homosexuality, which is malicus or soft, is the equivalent to the Latin word malus used in Roman culture to refer to men who played the woman in sexual relations. The word soft for the Roman was not all that different than the word gay in our culture. Manly men were not soft. They were dominant and hard. If you look at the Roman sculpture and art of Paul's day, you see the Roman ideal male as heavily muscled and powerful. Power had little room for mercy and expressed itself in cruelty. Now, an aside, you could get away with a certain amount of effeminacy, if you will, if your male dominance was unquestioned. So we have examples of both Nero and Caligula who were known to cross-dress. Nero, who was actually married to a dude in a public ceremony, Nero actually had two male, one was a wife, one was a husband to him. He played the female to his male husband and the male to the male so-called wife. So you were allowed to express this softness if, of course, you were Caesar and your maleness, your dominance was unquestioned. In fact, out of the first 12 Caesars, Suetonius records in his books, the 12 Caesars, 11 of the 12 were known to have homosexual liaisons. Only Claudius did not like that. So, again, back to the text. Men took what men wanted to the point of breaking those who got in their way. They dominated on the battlefield and in the bedroom. There's not much room in such a culture for feminine qualities. Marriage in Roman culture was where the rubber met the road in relation between the sexes. It was not a monolithic institution. There were various shades of marriage, if you will. Some marriages were what might be considered today to be open marriages, while others are more traditionally monogamous. In marriage, a woman was either given into the hand of her husband, who then assumed legal authority over her, or she could remain in the hand of her father, who then retained his role as her legal authority. Women were not equals with men in marriage, that is, in terms of sexual practice or rights under the law. Once married, a woman was expected to be sexually monogamous with her husband. Yet there are many examples of female infidelity in the Roman world. But the consequences for a wife's infidelity were severe. Caesar Augustus even legally mandated that a woman caught in adultery must be divorced at a minimum, or their husbands could be charged with pimping. If a husband killed his adulterous wife, his punishments were not to be severe. At other points in Roman history, that is earlier points, a man could kill his adulterous wife without any consequences. In fact, it was expected. By the way, another aside, the man who was caught in this adulterous relationship with a Roman wife, the penalty was to allow the Roman husband to rape the man as his punishment. Women faced the real possibility of death for adultery. Men did not. And while women were to remain sexually faithful to their husbands, husbands had social leeway to engage in intercourse outside the marriage. If he had slaves, it was understood that he could and probably would have intercourse with whichever of them caught his fancy, male or female alike. He was also likely to engage prostitutes. And this doesn't even mention the Roman institution of pederasty, in which men regularly had boys as sexual partners. The purpose of marriage was not necessarily to express love, but to establish equitable relations between families, or for the purpose of raising children. Tacitus is said to have written that the true Roman married without love, and loved without refinement or reverence. The woman was not bound to her husband by affection, but by legal arrangement. She was often the manager of the house and the house slaves, which freed the man to engage in more important work outside the home. Not surprisingly, there are texts complaining about how cruel some women were to their house slaves, punishing severely for minor issues. Roman culture as a whole was cruel. The primary value of a wife was rooted in her ability to produce heirs. And yet, many Roman women saw children as an inconvenience. The large numbers of infant bones found in ancient Roman sewers suggest as much. As does Caesar Augustus' legislation, known as the Lex Poppaea Poppaea, which granted special rewards to families with three or more children. Couples had to be baited with promises of financial reward to have multiple children. While occasionally finding ancient texts lauding womanly virtue, women were treated as little more than chattel. Their purpose was to have children and render affection according to their man's desires. Certain Roman marriage rites included the new bride willingly sitting on the phallus of a fertility god to give herself sexually to the gods before giving herself to her husband on their wedding night. She lived to please him sexually, not to be pleased. Some say that Roman culture was pro-family and pro-marriage, that they in fact advanced marriage from the Greeks. It is true that Greek wives had rooms in their homes where they were virtual prisoners and forbidden from going out in public. They were also deprived of education, so yes, Greek women had it worse. Roman wives shared meals with their husbands at the table. They enjoyed a level of education aimed at practical knowledge. They could leave the home on their own, provided they wore the long matron's dress. It was an improvement over the Greeks. Roman laws also gave women rights they did not have in previous centuries. In early Rome, a husband had to prove his wife had either committed adultery, drunk wine, or was perverse and disgusting in conduct in order to divorce her. In fact, drinking wine for women was punishable by death. So the law forbade men from simply divorcing their wives for no reason. Yet under the law, there were no legitimate recognized reasons for a wife to pursue a divorce from her husband. So in treatment of women under the law, the treatment of women under the law was not equal. One might therefore conclude that Rome was pro-family and pro-marriage, but this is only in comparison to the Greeks before them. By Christian standards, Roman marriage was hardly an institution to be copied. Now, just a few more comments on the Roman view of women. Livy wrote how in 131 BC a speech was given by a Roman censor that stated the following: "If we could live without wives, we should not have all this trouble, since nature has brought it about that we can neither live with them in peace nor without them at all. We must ensure eternal benefit rather than temporary pleasure." So the expression, "you can't live with them or without them," dates back to Roman times. As does the expression of a wife being the old ball and chain. Women lived under the authority of the paterfamilias, had absolutely no political rights. If Paul's view were shaped by his exposure to Roman culture, we would expect that his approach to marriage and the relation between the sexes would reflect at least some of these Roman understandings. He should, under this view, express a strong and unyielding male domination over women. He should see women as having no legal rights over their husbands in the eyes of God, and teach that women were biological necessities for procreation, but not necessarily important compared to their husbands. If the arguments of the left are correct, then both Jewish and Roman views about the relation between men and women should have been driving Paul's teachings on the order of creation. But the doctrine Paul taught was not consistent with either cultural view. Christianity proclaimed a completely different dynamic between the sexes than any other culture of the day. It had afforded a new and even radical dignity to womanhood. Often, all the opponents of the order of creation point to are the restrictions placed on women by Paul. Women are to submit to their husbands because the husband is the head of the home. Women should not occupy the office of pastor. They should not publicly teach men in the church. Because the order of creation does not permit women to fill all the roles God has given to men, opponents claim that it is oppressive and sexist. They ignore the elements of the order of creation that grant dignity and importance to womanhood. They ignore the value God places on women and the absolute equality of grace and mercy shown to the sexes. There is no hint in Paul's theology that women are less than men because they occupy different roles or vocations. And this was a radical departure from the Roman and Jewish cultures of Paul's day. Consider 1 Corinthians 7, 2-4. "Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband." You see the Greek? "Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does, and likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does." The language in verse 2 is unavoidably monogamous. Women and men were each to have their own spouse. Bedag states that idios connotes private, one's own, exclusively. Coupled with akaste, each, it becomes stronger yet. Paul states that women were each to have their own husbands, in the same sense that men were each to have their own wives. Men and women shared the same expectations of monogamy from the other, which broke with both Jewish and Roman cultural views. Polygamy, which was a given in the Jewish culture, is never encouraged by Paul, and extramarital liaisons, which was a given in Roman culture, are renounced throughout Paul's epistles in the strongest terms. Women had every right to expect the exclusive sexual attention of their husbands in the eyes of God. Verse 3 speaks of fulfilling a debt or paying what is due. Ophelein apodidato. Philene, there we are, that which is owed, a debt, one's due, an obligation, appetidato, meet, payout, fulfill, or yield. Husbands owe their wives a debt of gratitude in the same sense that wives owe their husbands. There's no suggestion that one owes the other more or less. Both are equal in what they owe to the other. Again, to both Roman and Jews, the woman would have owed her husband considerably more than he to her, since she was by definition less than him. It is truly a verse 4 is truly a radical idea that breaks completely with both Jewish and Roman views. It places the authority, exousia, of the husband's body under the wife's control. He is not his own to please himself as he wants. He is hers in the bedroom. More accurately, they are both equally under each other's authority in sexual relations. The wife had the right to expect and demand the same marital fidelity and love from her husband as he did from her. Instead of taking rights away from women or subjecting them under male domination, Paul's order of creation actually works to place men and women on equal par in terms of personal and sexual relations with one another. She is not less than he in the home, nor subject to his whims in the bedroom. Paul breaks again with prevailing views by stressing the importance of love in marriage, especially the love of husbands to their wives. This too is a radical break with prevailing views. It's not just any love Paul teaches, but Christological love. Ephesians 5 tells Christian husbands to love their wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. It is a love at an impossibly high standard apart from faith. It is a love born in sacrifice and constant attention to her needs. It is love with a Christological purpose, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as the Lord does the church. There is no room in this teaching for male domination. The wife is not subjugated. She is loved in a way that gives her hope and joy as Christ loved the church. Peter echoes Paul's respect for wives. Husbands likewise dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as the weaker vessel, and being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. There is a clear spiritual equality in the apostolic teaching. Christian husbands do not rule their homes. They are heads of the household, who love, honor, and dwell with their wives with understanding. In Timothy, Paul extends the honor due wives to widows as well. What Paul does in teaching this new relation of the sexes was radical to the point of genuinely upsetting the social order of Rome. The Romans considered Christian doctrine to be a direct attack on the natural order of things. Tacitus states that Christians were haters of humanity because they robbed the Roman populace of the comfort of their many gods and because they upset the social order. At Thessalonica, Christians were accused of turning the world upside down. My opinion is that these charges are at least in part due to the fact that Christianity redefined the relationship between men and women away from female oppression and subjugation toward an ethic of Christological love. Another example. Where both Roman and Jewish divorce laws allowed men to divorce their wives at will, and gave women little recourse to remove themselves from a bad marriage. In 1 Corinthians 7, Paul tells husbands not to divorce their wives, and further grants men and women equal freedom from the marriage should the other unbelieving spouse abandon the marriage. Later in the same chapter, he seems to distance himself from Jewish levirate marriage by giving women the right to marry whom they wanted upon the death of their husbands. Her freedom to choose her spouse was not subject to rabbinical law. There is a new dignity granted women under the law in Paul's theology. The headship of the Christian order of creation espoused by Paul is obviously something radically better than the domination of men over women in Roman culture and the legal control of men over women in Jewish culture. Paul is not parroting the cultural norms of his day. Yes, men and women are different, occupy different vocations, and have different roles in family, church, and society under the Pauline teaching. But unlike the dominant cultures of Paul's day, different did not mean less than. Not surprisingly, a faith that taught God loved men and women the same, that his redemption had given worth and value to all people, so that there is neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither slave nor free, there's neither male nor female, but all are one in Christ Jesus, was very attractive to those who were being marginalized, especially to women. Celsus, a second century detractor of the faith, once taunted that the church attracted only the silly and the mean and the stupid with women and children. His contemporary, Bishop Cyprian of Carthage, acknowledged in his Testimonia that Christian maidens were very numerous and that it was difficult to find Christian husbands for all of them. These comments give us a picture of a church disproportionately populated by women. The order of creation implicit throughout Christian teaching was a liberating doctrine for women. Unlike today's progressives, they did not see matters of headship and submission as oppressive or restrictive. They found freedom from the oppression of the world in God's created order. Still, some might argue that the women who found the Christian faith preferable to the oppression of Roman male domination or rabbinical rules were from the lower social strata. They were women who were truly oppressed, like slaves and the poor. Women who knew a greater measure of freedom and were able to engage in activities that exceeded the strictures of the Christian orders of creation would never have subjugated themselves under Christian sexual roles. But again, history shows that this isn't true either. Especially in the 3rd and 4th centuries, many Christian converts came from the upper levels of Roman society. There were even women who converted to Christianity who had tasted the so-called freedom to engage in activities God's order gave only to men, like the priesthood. History records the examples of two prominent Roman priestesses who turned to Christ. Daria was a Vestal virgin who converted to Christianity around 280 AD, and Celia Concordia was the last chief Vestal virgin and converted in the late 4th century. There are examples of other Vestals whose names have been chiseled off inscriptions who are believed to have been converted and then struck from memory by Rome. The Vestals were the ultimate priestesses in the Roman Empire. There were usually 6 Vestals serving in the temple to the goddess Vesta. They were chosen between the ages of 6 and 10 from good Roman families. They had to be free from any physical defect or blemish. A Vestal was expected to serve for 30 years, though they seemed to have hardly ever retired. The duty of a Vestal was to tend the sacred hearth fire from which every fire throughout Rome was kindled. She was considered the very image of Rome and was honored wherever she went. Romulus and Remus were said to be born from a Vestal virgin. So Vestals were portrayed as the mothers of Rome. They were free to go out in public and attend public events. They were special guests wherever they went. It's said they were given front row seats at all sporting events. So if a Vestal touched a slave, the slave was made free. If a Vestal was seen by a prisoner on his way to execution, the prisoner's life was spared. The Vestals also made a flower called the mola salsa that was to be sprinkled on every sacrifice to any god in Rome. No god could be worshipped in Rome without this gift of the Vestals. This effectively made the Vestals the supreme high priestesses of all religions in Rome. They were, to be sure, the most powerful women in Rome. Yet a handful of Vestals turned away from their so-called sexual liberation and embraced Christ. They did not consider Christianity repressive because it redefined who they were and what offices they could occupy. They submitted themselves to a male priesthood and to the worship of the one true triune God. It is a testament to the fact that the perceived oppression of the order of creation seen by modern progressives was not at all oppressive to those early Christian converts. Clearly, the argument that Paul was only parroting his culture when he spoke of sex-specific roles within the family and church crumbles in the face of the historical record. Paul's views on the sexes were not defined by his culture, nor were his views oppressive. On the contrary, the order of creation as taught by Paul was radically freeing to those who were oppressed by the confusion of their age. I would submit that in our age, the order of creation remains a freeing doctrine in the face of society's corruption of the relationship between the sexes. Christ's power to give hope to those crushed by the world remains active and alive in a world bent on denying Him. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Pastor Rieger. Any questions?
Thank you, Dr. Rieger. That was very good. I have a question. So conservatives today will often defend the attacks of Western civilization by saying that it gave rise to the freedom that we now enjoy. And oftentimes they'll connect that with the Bible and Christianity. But when they talk about the freedoms, oftentimes they include the freedoms that are actually not freedoms, the sexual revolution of today and things like that. So what I'm asking is if you could comment on looking at what Paul wrote as different from this freedom that people are claiming now. That's not what he was expressing, but at the same time being truly liberating. And then also, people say a lot that we're reverting back to the paganism of ancient Rome. But what you say here, it seems so much more male dominant. If you could maybe touch on that too, that the feminist culture that says, oh no, this is liberating women, but it's really enslaving them. And it seems like the Romans did it intentionally, and it seems that it's inadvertent now.
I think that's true. The Romans did intentionally, through their sexual practices, enslave women. And it was, you know, it was right out there in public. There really wasn't any sort of Roman feminism that was seeking for female rights, and if there had been, they probably would have been killed. Romans were not above shedding blood very quickly. Today's is the same and yet different. I mean, you're correct in that it's seeking the same sort of sexual image of Rome's freedom to do what you will. What modern sexual progressives today are looking for is something very similar to a Roman sexual utopia. All the while ignoring the fact that along with that sexual freedom, that actually that sexual freedom was sexual domination, not freedom. It's a misreading of their sexual freedom. And along with that license to do what one wanted sexually went an immense amount of cruelty and objectification of other human beings. It was sex purely for self-gratification, which, again, today's progressives may think is a good thing, but when you compare it to the actual practice of that sexual gratification in history, you see was covered with blood from one part of Rome to the other. Yeah, they want what they consider to be the best, which is free license, while ignoring the reality of the worst that went along with it, which is the objectification of other human beings. That what Paul introduced, what Christianity introduced, was a view of sexuality that was totally self-emptying and serving of the other. Totally selfless. And I would submit, not only does that affect sexual relations, relations between men and women, but the whole of society. That along with that selfless attitude towards the opposite sex is a selfless attitude towards any human being. And that's where your ultimate freedoms arise from, that Christianity brought to bear away from Roman enslavement. A genuine respect for other human beings, so things like slavery, which was commonplace throughout the Roman Empire, no longer was consistent with Christian teaching or Christian society. And so many of the old oppressive orders disappeared simply because the foundation of Christological love is to empty oneself and yield to the other. So, yeah, if the old adage of if you don't know history, you're bound to repeat it. It's the liberals who are cherry-picking what they think is the best of history while ignoring the true ugliness of it all. Was there another part to that I missed?
No, I think you answered it. I didn't ask it very well, but it just seems that people rewrite history, and then so they say that what Christianity did was liberate women, which is true from what you say, but then what they mean by liberty is then the enslavement. But Christians will often say we're going back to pagan Rome,
right.
But from what you're saying, that's not really true. They're kind of accidentally doing some of the things, but it's not completely true.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe it'll eventually get to that point. But our culture isn't intentionally male dominance.
Right.
It just ends up that way.
Yeah, true.
Any other questions?
Well, I might as well. I had to think something up as I was walking to the mic. No, I'm just kidding. Just to kind of pick up from what James is just saying, with the male dominance, when St. Peter describes the woman as the weaker vessel, and that, there's just this assumption that the woman is weaker. And it seems like in our culture, in our society, you can't say that. And they'll even make fictional, make up fictional movies about women who become Navy SEALs and stuff like that, because they want to live in a fantasy world. But there seems to be what you're describing is that in ancient Rome, it reminds me of the distinction between the true religion and the false kind of mythological religions that live in la-la land. If you simply satisfy your sexual desires and you are domineering on your wife, it's going to come back and bite you. And what happened to Rome? Rome fell. And so then with us, you can't ignore the fact that the man is going to be more dominant than the woman. If you try to ignore that and put a Band-Aid over it and pretend it's not there, then, then the gods of the Copybookheadians with terror and slaughter will return. So does Paul have a more down-to-earth approach then, would you say, that he actually recognizes a certain reality? He's not when he understands this Christologically, he's not simply saying, ignore your circumstances, ignore the reality that men are stronger than women, but actually facing that reality, and this is how we're going to face it, in a much more practical way. Basically, what I'm asking is that Paul when he addresses it Christologically, as you say, does this become a much more practical, in down-to-earth, realistic approach to our world, or is this something that you simply have to take by faith and human reason is going to, rail against it? And maybe it's both, but...
Yeah, it's difficult to know how to answer that. It obviously was something more real and more inviting and more... touching people's circumstances for the women who were converting at the time that heard this come from Paul in light of where they had grown up. They were attracted to it. And in terms of how they actually lived in practice, I have no doubt that they did find this was a practical way of recognizing. As you say, a male is, by nature dominant. dominant is necessarily the word, especially as we're using it in the context of Rome, where dominance kind of equates to oppression. Men are physically stronger, mentally different. And Paul's teaching on the orders of creation is for men to recognize the fact that they need to set aside their kind of natural male aggressiveness, if you will, maybe that's a better word, and love. You know, show tenderness. And I think that is a real recognition of man's nature as being different and a practical way of expressing it within the home. Men simply need to yield as Christ yielded to our weaknesses and lowered himself to us. Not that women are lower than men.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I guess what I was kind of getting at too is that the when you ignore, as our society does, when you work to ignore and pretend that there isn't this difference, then women are the ones who get hurt more.
Oh yeah.
You know, they're the ones who get they're given this fantasy that they can do everything a man can do. Well, then suddenly she's on the front lines of the battlefield.
Right.
And so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hi, Clint Stark, pastor, St. John, Frisco, Texas. I just have a question on page 8, the second to last paragraph. There is a clear spiritual equality in the apostolic teaching. Christian husbands do not rule their homes, their heads, etc. Could you talk a little more about that, I guess, in light of 1 Timothy 3:4, in regards to pastors, one that ruleth well his own household? Thank you.
Rule in the sense of dominate. Rule in the sense of sort of the Roman absolute ruler mentality. The word rule, I suppose, can be interpreted from a Christian point of view as headship and doesn't have to have the negative connotation. But I think as I used it there, I meant it in terms of in comparison with the ideas of rule that the Romans were putting out there. Or for that matter, the rabbinical teaching, where their view of a male ruling his home was pretty much unilateral rule without even consideration for the woman. Whereas everything we've been hearing from the other lectures about male headship is the importance of considering the woman ahead of one's own will in decision-making, in headship. All right?
And then Rolf will be next.
Thank you, Dr. Rieger. Great, great talk. I was wondering if you could comment a bit about relationships, say like in the Iliad between Hector and Andromache. These are like literature that the Romans, the Greeks would have been reading, which actually do set forth a nice marriage, a happy marriage, where the wife loves her husband, the husband loves his wife, they've got a child, and they're happy together. You could probably say the same thing about Penelope and Odysseus in the Odyssey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are certainly a number of Roman images of a doting husband and a loving wife and a loving family. It's funny though; most of them usually wind up being tragedies. I think there was a war fought over Helen, and several of the other virtuous women wind up committing suicide in order to maintain their virtue in the face of male rape and domination. So, yeah, the examples of womanly virtue are there. But sort of as an ideal that really didn't see a whole lot of practical application in the normal daily family life of your Roman husband coming home to his wife. Among the myths in my book, I comment how the Roman gods really are the model for Roman morality. And Zeus being the supreme Roman god, sort of the setter of the moral code for all the rest of the gods. It's one story after another of him fathering children from various women. So, yeah, womanly virtue and monogamy with her husband was lauded as a Roman virtue. But the other side of that with men and their wives, while they were at times affectionate, and there are these nice stories of that, that still doesn't preclude him going out and having an affair, raping a slave or something like that.
Thank you for your paper. I would like to just put a little more emphasis on the fact that this is not what Paul did. This is not what Paul broke with. This is not what Paul did or taught. It's Paul wrote down what God told him to write. So this is really God's teaching, not Paul's teaching.
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions? There's no such thing as a quick anything from you.
Yes. I would just be interested in hearing a little bit more about your Iowa State experience and the kids that came in with this anti-Christian worldview and what approach you took, and if you had any success in having them hear the clear Word of God.
That's how the whole ball kind of started. I tell the story a little bit about it in my book. My now son-in-law was dating my daughter at the time, going to Iowa State at an ethics class. He came home to visit my daughter, complaining regularly about his ethics class and what he was hearing, especially on homosexuality and marriage. So I suggested to him that in the interest of academic freedom, he go to his professor and just say, look, you know, just to be fair, so we can hear other points of view, how about bringing in opposing perspective on these things? I never really expected he actually would talk to his professor, but he did. And then certainly didn't expect that I was going to wind up being the one giving the counterpoint, but somehow that happened too. So I get this email from a professor asking me to come in and address the class and bring what he called a conservative view of Christian marriage to present to his ethics class after they had been well prepped on what's wrong with Christians. And he was, I got to say, he was from Iceland. He kind of had this European academic freedom mentality, which I appreciate. I think he was an atheist. He disagreed with everything I said. But he let me have his class. He basically turned it over. And the way he introduced me was he would introduce me and then tell his class, now be respectful, but go after him. That's how every class started. And then I had a chance to do this for 3 years. One class each semester for 3 years. And they did. They went after me. So I would give about half the class as a presentation and then half the class as bring it on. And they were never shy. I had some student get up, walk out of the classroom, slam the door behind him, you know, mad, just to prove how mad he was at what I had to say. And other students did try and debate me, some intelligently, some not so. But after every class, I would get kids lining up out in the hallway saying, you know, thanks, because nobody says this around here, and I was beginning to think I was the only person left thinking these things. So there were some students who were strengthened and reinforced in this. But the whole purpose, well, the whole origins of my book are just sort of putting out there my experience, the things that I heard coming at me to help other kids, especially college age, defend themselves from these same things that they're definitely going to hear at the university.
So the audience of the book is college age people?
I mean, basically I wrote it for my own kids who are going to the university.
Okay.
And to help prepare them for the sorts of arguments they're going to hear against Christian morality. That was the intention, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Any others?
Thank you for your words and presentation, very thought-provoking. Craig Niemeyer, blessed to serve God's people at Zion Lutheran Church in Worms, Nebraska. Just thinking about If you would, take a snapshot or maybe a poll of some of the advances that have happened. I have four girls. Workplace opportunity, college enrollment, access to college, an environment where some maybe on the left would say this is a time in our society and culture where women are able to thrive. But then looking at some of those same benchmarks, and my sense is that our 20 and early 30-year-old males are not thriving. I think that college enrollment is down, home ownership, at what age and point we take on responsibilities that benefits not only me but others in society, that that guys maybe kind of, maybe it's an oversimplification, but are in general floundering by some of the advancements that have happened. I just am curious in terms of Christian, I attribute that in part to a waning influence of Christian value, Christian worldview on society around us. Curious about that, your thoughts and opinions on that. Curious to say where a Christian worldview has some influence. Has that indeed, and how has that benefited both male and female?
Yeah, there's an hour-long answer waiting to happen. Certainly Christianity has opened up respect for all people and the gifts God has given them. I always liked Margaret Thatcher. There's a woman that was just a brick wall against her opponents. Fierce. And yet, if you ever saw Margaret with her husband, when I did, at least on TV, she seemed to change when she was in the context of home. He was a real mild-mannered, kind of quiet guy. But her demeanor around him, she yielded to him. She wasn't the same fierce, combatant woman in the home as she was in Parliament. There's no reason why a woman can't use the gifts God has given her to her full ability and yet maintain the orders of creation. They are not exclusive. So I do think that Christianity and Christian culture does afford women the opportunity to be what God made them to be, both in the home and outside the home. Without violating the idea of the headship of the husband in the home or her submission to him or respect in society. So, yeah, I mean, I think Christian culture is largely responsible for that. But, of course, with all things, as soon as the secular world gets a hold of it and feminism, it corrupts it into something that tries to drive a wedge between the orders of creation and a woman's opportunities. Sexism is still real. My daughters, who are now grown, my eldest daughter just finished her doctorate of music at Ohio State and complained constantly throughout the process that she was always being relegated to the back seats in favor of men who, skill-wise and talent-wise, were not at her par. So, I mean, that kind of thing happens in secular society for all its claims of liberation. So it's not really an answer other than Christianity, I think, does not, the order of creation does not make it impossible for women to use the talents God blessed her with.
Question.
I have been instructed to ask you a question. But thank you very much. I thoroughly enjoyed your talk. And yesterday we're talking about patriarchy from a Christian perspective, and we're seeing good things about it. And now, today, you're talking about patriarchy from that old Roman perspective, and we see some pretty bad things about it. And so I guess my question is, when you have these students, do they have any concept of what we actually believe in, or do they ascribe to us Christians the type of abusive circumstance that existed back then? In other words, are they condemning us because they understand our position or because they really don't understand our position?
No, they're condemning us because they don't understand our position. They have been led to believe that Christian morality and the relation between the sexes is nothing more than a first century cultural product. And there's no recognition that Christianity is any different than Rome or ancient Judaism. In fact, I actually made a statement in one of the classes that I actually believe the Bible is true. And I had a student raise his hand and said, "The professor said there are still people like you out there, but you know, I've never met one."
Hi, I've had an opportunity as a substitute teacher to teach a health class in my health class, and by coincidence, it would be on sex, and I would say to the kids, which had nothing to do with the curriculum, that when you should abstain from sex until you get married for the sake of protecting your children and your spouse because of all the sexual diseases, and you do want your child to have a regular a healthy family. And does that ever come up? I mean, to me, it's a practice. It's not just it's godly, but it's also very practical that you're out of self-preservation and to have a happy life on earth. You just don't want to have fatherless kids. Or, you know, having multiple kids. I mean, you hear all these awful jokes about, you know, like that awful joke about a mother naming all her children the same name but calling them by their last name if she wants one specifically. You know, it's just kind of sad. I mean, because this is really what's happening. I see this in the classrooms, that these kids don't have a family like I have.
Right. That discussion wasn't so much part of my experience at Iowa State, but I did write a chapter on sex education in the sexual ethics book Grobin edited. And that is a big issue, that the proponents in modern sex education, the proponents of an ethic that is guided by nothing more than consent, and that this talk of, you know, use proper protection in order to be safe and all that, the bottom line is it doesn't work, period.
Right.
And there's just nothing historically you can do to argue to the contrary with that. That, in fact, sexual diseases, there's now 20-something different sexual diseases out there during this so-called age of protection as compared to, pre-1940s, where this sort of free sexuality was unthinkable, and there was like 2 venereal diseases. So the older order of saving yourself, there is no question in terms of practicality, is the only way of protecting your family. No, because the trump card is that you are a sexual being in their mind, in a modern sex education. You are defined by your sexuality. You are a sexual being, therefore you have to express it. And the thought of actually not being sexually active is unthinkable in their worldview. Because it somehow denies their humanity as far as they're concerned.
Thank you.
We will draw the line at Preuss grandkids.
Pastor Brockman from far western Kansas, would you not say that there's a difference between the rabbinical, pharisaical teaching of sexual or marriage ethics and the prophetical, I don't know if I'm inventing a word here, pentateuchal view of marriage and sexual ethics? And if there is, did not Paul incorporate that, not only Paul, but then the whole New Testament too? Is that not part of the New Testament from even before the Pharisees and the rabbis?
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. And you know, there wasn't really space in this paper to explore that, but yes, the Old Testament view of the relation of the sexes was corrupted by rabbinical teachings. And their rabbinical law does not accurately reflect the Old Testament. Now, the one element of patriarchal practice that Paul does disavow is the polygamy thing. But in terms, even it just plain never worked when you look at it, but even in terms of the respect afforded in the patriarchal polygamy, the Abraham, Jacob, the way they interacted with more than one partner, they still had a level of respect and honor there that Paul carries over into the New Testament, that the whole New Testament carries over. You know, when Sarah was having her conflict with Hagar, she goes to Abraham and says, get rid of her. And it, you know, the Old Testament says that Abraham heeded the voice of his wife. He respected her opinion. So he didn't dominate her. There was genuine love and respect within the family, even in a polygamous situation, which the rabbis kept a polygamy, but then added the level of sort of disrespect of women and to that. Whereas Paul restores the level of respect while eliminating the polygamy.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. Let's thank Pastor Dr. Rieger. You can go ahead and put that back up there. Just hang on just a second. I'll make one quick announcement. I'm going to dismiss you for lunch. Remember the book signing at 1 o'clock. The announcement is we do still have copies of the DVD, If Not Now, When? And we don't have those here. If you would still like a copy, you can go online and order one, and we'll get that to you. Two, if you don't want a copy, you can still download the program from YouTube. So it's in two parts, and you can look at it on YouTube. Yes?
If you type in ACLC in search, that's the first one that pops up.
Yeah. Or if you just do If Not Now, it's the first one, too. Yeah, there's the two-parter and the whole thing together. So, and then You can get that. Again, we will dismiss for lunch and be back here. If you don't want to be part of the book signing, which I hope you do, be back for our 1:15, and then 1:30 we'll begin again. Thank you.